May we continue with what we were talking about yesterday. We were saying, weren't we, that our brain, whole of our mind also, has lived through many, many experiences, many accidents, every form of experience, and has accumulated a great deal of knowledge. And it has, that knowledge has formed a pattern according to which we live. And that pattern has been created through time. Not only time necessary to learn a language, to learn any kind of technique, skill, but also that very knowledge has created a whole structure of our existence, psychologically, inwardly, inside the skin, as it were. And apparently, after many million years, we have hardly psychologically changed at all. We have become more modified, more cunning, capable of arguing intelligently or semi-intelligently. And this pattern, which has been created through time, and that pattern, unless it is completely broken, as we went into it yesterday, we will not be able to create a new society. The society in which we live, with its walls, immorality, with its violence, terror, with its constant uncertainty, has been created by human beings. Whether we live here, in the Far East or Near East, it has been structured, put together by human beings. And unless the human beings psychologically, radically, profoundly change, society cannot be changed. They have experimented, as the communists have done, change the environment, hoping thereby to change man. Of course, it never can be done. Man overcomes the environment, and so on, so on, so on. So, if one is at all serious, concerned with the world events, with all the confusion and misery in which we all live, it becomes absolutely necessary to bring about a psychological revolution in ourselves. We said thought has created this mad, insane world. Thought thinks that it is rational, capable, in certain fields, in the technological, in the world of commerce, and so on. There it is fairly rational. But psychologically, it is totally irrational. Thought, as we said yesterday, is the outcome of memory, experience, knowledge. And we also said yesterday that thought is a matter. And whatever it creates must belong to that. And can that thought, which is limited, as knowledge is always limited, can that thought bring about a radical change in itself? That's what we are talking about yesterday. And we should go much further into the problem. Also, please bear in mind that we are talking over together. It's not the speaker talking and you listening, but rather both of us. You exercising our brain, our capacities, our intellect, if we are rational, think over this problem together. Which does not mean you accept what the speaker is saying, but rather, together you and he go into the matter. You know, he said an extraordinary thing. In the Eastern religions, doubt is encouraged. To doubt. In the Western world, religious world, doubt is substituted, faith is substituted for doubt. You understand what I'm saying? So, our minds are rather more inclined to accept rather than to examine. Our brains refuses to see something new because it's caught in the same old pattern. And we are going to examine that pattern. Because we are not advocating any faith, on the contrary. We are not saying that you must believe or not believe. We are not doing any kind of propaganda, which is all too silly in these matters. So we are going together, examine the whole issue that's involved in our human existence. Fermi suggests, please don't take notes. One can't pay attention while you're taking notes. Sorry. And please don't take photographs and or tape records and all that kind of thing because it disturbs others. So kindly refrain from doing all that kind of thing. I hope you don't mind. It's not a matter of copyright or anything of that kind. It's merely for the convenience and the distraction that takes place when you're taking photographs and so on. What we are trying to do together is to examine what's going on now. Not only in the world, but also in ourselves, as we read last few talks. So we're asking whether this pattern of existence, in which the brain has established itself, seeking security, because there's a primary need for the brain to be completely secure. Whether that security is in an illusion or in some fanciful idea or some romantic concept or is in an image, spiritual, religious and all that kind of thing, or the image that you have about your wife or your husband or your boyfriend, girlfriend and all that business. So the brain is always trying to find security, because it's only there then that it can function somewhat skillfully. This pattern has been put together by desire, first by thought, by desire, by through attachment, through greed, and though it is caught in fear, it seems incapable of escaping from that, or overcoming that, or being free from it. If you will kindly examine these three things together, that is desire, though we examined together yesterday and the previous talks, the whole movement of thought, desire, greed, attachment, fear. That's the pattern in which we're caught. And is it possible to break this pattern? Please inquire together with the speaker. That is, let's think over the matter together. Not that I am explaining and you are accepting, or you are rejecting and so on, but that is the problem that confronts us. Desire has created so many problems, both sexual various forms of objects towards desire drives, and desire to achieve success, desire to be better than somebody and so on and so on. This whole competitive existence of human beings. Perhaps competition is destroying the world. Superpowers and so on. The importance given to success, to fulfillment, to achievement and so on. So we have to examine together the nature of desire. We are not saying you must suppress or fulfill desire or evade or overcome, but we are examining the whole momentum, the movement of desire. We are following each other. Religions, that is the institutionalized acceptance of some dogmas, rituals, images and so on, those religions have said desire must be suppressed. In order to serve God, you must come without any desire. I don't know if you have gone into it, but we needn't go into that matter now. So, but we are not saying we must do that. We are examining. If we can understand the nature and the structure of desire, not verbally or intellectually, but actually, factually, then perhaps desire has its proper place. But now desire is so consuming all. Instant fulfillment of desire, whether it's in meditation, whether it's in taking coffee, whether going somewhere or other, it must be fulfilled. It must be acted upon instantly. Restraint is looked down upon, is even denied. But we are saying, before we do anything about desire, whether it's right or wrong, whether it's noble or ignoble, whether it has proper place in society and so on, so on, we must understand the nature of it. Right, sirs? Are we following each other? Good. What is desire? What is the root of it? Not merely the objects of desire, which vary according to our age, according to our circumstances, environment, pressure, and so on. What is the root of desire? How does desire come into being? And why does desire play such an extraordinary part in one's life? Right? Please, sirs. As we said, we are talking over together, seeing the nature of desire, not according to the speaker. As he pointed out earlier, then we must have doubt. Doubt is a very cleansing thing. But also, doubt must be kept on a leash, as you keep it on a dog is kept on a leash. You must let the dog go sometimes, run. But also, you must keep it on a leash occasionally. So in the same way, doubt is an extraordinary quality of cleansing the mind. But also it must be kept on a leash. So we are saying, together, let us talk over the nature of desire and find out its proper place. What is desire? How does it come into being with all of us? With the most highly sophisticated, educated intellectuals, with the ordinary person, and also with all those monks and saints who are consumed by desire. You may take a vow of celibacy, as the monks do, all over the world. But desire is burning in them. So we must carefully examine this thing. Right, sirs? How do you approach this problem? You understand? How do you, when you want to examine the nature of desire, how do you look at it? Do you understand my question? How do you consider or observe the movement of desire? If you are conditioned, your approach will naturally be partial. If you are enormously consumed by desire, then it will also be very limited. But to examine the nature of it, one must have somewhat a free mind. Right, sir? So let's do it together. There is not only visual seeing, that is, you see something very beautiful and that the perception of it, the seeing of it, creates a sensation, right? That sensation, there is sensation, contact, right? The seeing, the sensation, the contact, then what takes place after that? You understand my question? What I'm saying? You see something, a woman, man, car, picture. This seeing creates the sensation. Then the touching of it. Then what takes place? You're following this? Please follow it, otherwise I will be talking and you will merely be listening, which will lead us nowhere. So where does desire begin? Seeing, contact, sensation. Then thought creates the image. And when thought has created the image through that seeing, sensation, contact, then thought creates the image. Thought makes that desire to possess or not to possess. Right? I wonder if you're following this. You see a shirt or a suit or a dress, a car, or a beautiful woman or a man, whatever it is. There is the sensation, contact, then thought creates the image, you in that shirt, in that dress, or in the car. At that moment, desire is born. You following all this? It's not what I am telling you. You are discovering this for yourselves. Right? Are we going together? So desire is born when thought creates the image. When there is seeing, contact, sensation, then thought with its image, sitting in the car, driving the car, or wanting, you follow? The whole momentum takes place. Then arises the question, if you're interested in it, is it possible to see something, the sensation is natural, the contact is natural, but to see when thought arises with its image, desire creates all kinds of complications. Right? I wonder if you're following all this. So the question is it possible for thought not to create the image at all? You understand? That is, seeing the car, the sensation, thought saying, creating the image of you driving in that car, the power, the position, you know, all the fun of it. But before thought creates the image, not to allow that image to be formed. I wonder if you follow me. Is that concrete? Have you understood something at all? Are we moving together? Huh? So we are saying discipline is not conformity. Right? But the very observation of the whole movement of desire creates its own order. Following on. You do it now as you're sitting there. What's your desire? You must have desire for something, even for heaven, for illumination, for beauty, for goodness, whatever it is. Observe how this desire comes into being. And the moment when thought creates the image, then there is the whole of that energy directed. You follow? Are you capturing something? So, desire then does not make disorder as it is doing now. That is, then, in the understanding of the nature of desire, that very understanding is order, in which there is no suppression, no conformity, no conflict. Have you understood any of this? Well, sir, have some of you not understood, see how the desire works for yourself. Then you will see that every form of controlling desire, suppressing desire, overcoming desire, ends. Because you see how desire comes into being. And before it arises, you are aware the whole nature of the movement of desire. I wonder if you are. Understand it, sir? I must talk to someone, I don't know. You know. So greed is a form of desire. Greed is encouraged by all the by the industrialists, by the commercial, in all that business. It's encouraged. And that's become an immense problem in this world. Materialism is part of this greed. Then from that you can move to the question of attachment. Most of us are attached to something or other. May be a piece of property, a old furniture, or a picture, or an idea, or a belief, or an experience. Watch yourself, please. You know you're attached to something, or to a person, to some experience that one has had. Where there is attachment, please listen, just observe the consequence of attachment. We're not saying you mustn't be attached. Just observe the nature of attachment. And then out of that observation comes right action with regard to attachment. If you're attached to a belief, why and why? What is the nature of that belief? Who has created the belief? You're attached to a religious concept, a religious image, or to a person. What is implied in that attachment? First, please just listen. You understand? Just listen. Then we can move together. You know you're attached to something. Why? Is it that you are lonely? Is it by being attached to something you feel sufficient in yourself? Is it that if you are not attached to anything, you feel completely isolated, empty? Is it being attached to a person gives you a comfort, security, a sense of identification? The consequences of all that is the loss of it, the fear of losing it, jealousy, anxiety, hatred, a sense of being deeply wounded. So, attachment will inevitably lead to all this. Right? Now, when the speaker explains all this, is it an idea or an actuality? You understand what I'm saying? Have you formed an idea of attachment? Or you actually see for yourself that you are attached and see for yourself the consequences of it. And so it is not an idea which you accept, but you are observing the movement of attachment. Right? Now, what will you do about it? You understand my question? What is, when you have observed the nature of attachment, how thought creates the image about a person and is attached to that image. Right? And to the person. The image is far more important than the person. I wonder if you're following all this. So, can attachment, with all that consequences, which brings great conflict, misery, confusion, antagonism, can all that end? Then, what takes place when you end attachment? You follow? No, sir, please, no. You understand my question? You are attached. You know, you have intellectually or actually observed the consequences of attachment, with its conflict, fear, and so on. Is it an action of will to say, I will end attachment? Or you have an insight into attachment? If you have an insight into attachment, because you see the whole moment, the movement of it, then there is an ending of it. Not that you are attached to something else. You understand? One may be attached to that person or to that idea, and letting that attachment go and be attached to another person, another idea. We are talking the ending of all attachment, which brings enormous psychological conflict. Have you the insight into it, and therefore end it? Then what takes place? When you end something, you understand? When you stop drinking, if you do, or when you stop smoking, or any of those things, both physically and psychologically, what happens? You want me to tell you? You see, that is the danger. That's how you create authority, dependence on another. Whereas if you discover for yourself, when you end an attachment completely, what is the state of the mind that has been caught in the pattern and in the movement of that attachment? What happens to the mind? Something totally new takes place, doesn't it? You have broken the pattern of attachment. Therefore, naturally something other than this pattern comes into being. Really? Are you doing this? See, you're all so frightened. That's the root of it. So we have to examine what is fear. You're interested in all this.
Yes? Not casual, you know, sitting under the trees in a lovely morning and looking at the leaves, the light on the leaves and so on, enjoying it, and those mountains behind. We are saying something very, very serious. You can't play with this kind of thing. Because it will radically transform your way of living. And if you don't want to be radically transformed, don't listen to all this. Probably you are not anyhow. But if you are serious, you may be listening. So we are not entertaining you intellectually or emotionally or romantically. It's a very, very serious matter of life. So we've said desire, greed, attachment. This is part of our life. Daily struggling, conflict, occasionally happy life. And we're now, let us examine together, and I mean together, what is fear? Why we are so frightened? And this problem of fear has not been solved at all, though we have lived 1,000,000,000 years. We're still carrying on in the same old pattern of fear. So what is fear? And isn't one afraid of letting go of attachment? Whether the attachment to a person, belief, a concept. The communists have created a concept. And if you talk to a communist, card-carrying communist, he's afraid to let that pattern go. He won't think of anything anew, right? Or talk to a very practicing Catholic or a Protestant or any Hindu Buddhist, it's the same thing. They're afraid. Because in that pattern, in a conclusion, in a belief, there is security. There's a sense of stability. Strength. Whether that idea, that image, that concept be an illusion, that very illusion gives you security. In attachment, there is a certain sense of well-being, safe. Right, sirs? We are not analyzing. We are merely observing the movement of fear, which is totally different from analysis. I know there are a great many analysts here. They think I don't understand, I'm a bit peculiar on this matter. rather conditioned, peculiar, rather crazy. I met many of them, I know them. So we are not analyzing. I want to make this perfectly clear. Because analysis implies the exercise of thought. Thought is partial, limited, because all knowledge is limited. And always living within the shadow of ignorance. An analysis is a process of exercising knowledge that has been acquired and operating from that knowledge. We are saying quite the contrary. Observation is entirely different from analysis. Just to observe the nature of fear. So it becomes very important to understand what is observation. Observation which is not, let me repeat it 1,000 times, not analysis. So what is observation? To observe. To observe that thing without naming that thing. Because the moment you have named that thing as a tree, you are observing it with a word, with a concept, with an image. Right? Go into some with me for a moment. But to observe that thing without the word. If you can do it. And that's comparatively easy. But to observe psychologically your reactions, all that goes on inwardly, just to observe it, without saying it's good or bad, this is hate, this is wrong, this is right, without any movement of thought, just to observe. Right? So we are observing the reaction which we call fear. Fear that comes into being when you feel that it is necessary to have, not to be attached, not to be, whatever it is. Then the immediate reaction is fear. Because in attachment you have found security, safety, sense of protection. And when, with the ending of that, there is the quivering of what is going to happen. Can I tell my wife or my husband or boy, whatever it is, I'm not attached? What will she do or he do? You understand what I'm saying? So, we are now examining together observing the nature and the movement of fear. That means your mind is free from all analytical conditioning. Right? Is it free? Or you hold that back, the analytical process, and you say, well, I will observe without analysis. That can't be done. That's only playing games. To observe, the whole sense of analytical conditioning must end. Otherwise you cannot observe properly, accurately. Because all our education, all our conditioning is to analyze. See the cause, see the effect, try to change the effect, and so on, so on, so on. Only analysis is much more complex than that, but I'm just putting it very briefly, rather insufficiently. But to observe is much more arduous than analysis. To observe your wife or your husband or your boy or whatever it is, without the image that you have created about that person. You understand my question? Each one of us have an image about the person with whom we live. And that in that image there is security. But that image is not the actual person. How that image is created, whether that image can end, is a different problem. Which is, that image is created by thought, by constant interaction, and that image is with which we live. And so the image and the actuality are two different things, right? And so there's conflict, obviously. The struggle between two people, man, woman, or man, so on, so on. Constant struggle, conflict between two people. But they live on images. When there is no image, perhaps there will be love, compassion, affection, care. So, let us together observe the nature of fear. Why, after millions and millions of years, we have not resolved that problem? You understand my question, sir? Why? We have resolved many problems outwardly in the world, in the environment, and so on. But fear is not out there, but in us. It's a psychological reaction. And why haven't we, with all our cunning, with all our knowledge, with all of our experience, resolved this problem of fear completely? Is it we have never looked at ourselves, but always relied on others to tell us what we are? You understand what I mean? We have never looked at ourselves, actually what we are. Not according to the philosophers, psychologists and the experts, because they themselves have never looked at themselves. They have ideas about themselves. Is it that we have never observed ourselves as we observe ourselves in a mirror? The mirror, if it is clean mirror, then it doesn't distort. It shows exactly what you are, what your face is like. But to so observe ourselves without any distortion, demands that you look without any motive, without any desire, without any pressure, just to watch, just to observe. So similarly, we're going to observe the movement of fear. Most of us are afraid. We're not talking about physical fears that are also involved, but losing a job, all that. Not having employment, not having enough money, having had pain, physical pain, fear of not having the pain again. So there are all the physical fears. And it's much more important to understand first the psychological fears. Because then perhaps we can do something about physical fears more sanely, rationally. Right? May we proceed? We are doing it together. No, you're not listening to me. We are together observing this extraordinary thing called fear, which man has carried for a million years. And the speaker says it can be ended completely, psychologically, all fear. If you have the capacity to observe this fear, not direct it, not say I mustn't have it or I must have it, I must, all that. What is fear? Is fear time? You understand? Time being that which has happened yesterday and that which might happen tomorrow. You understand? Which is time. Is that the cause of fear? Go into it slowly. Let's go into slowly. Because when we have finished observing fear this morning, it must end so completely that you have no psychological fears at all. Then you are a rational, sane human being. Because at present we are irrational. Is fear time? That is, having had knowledge of fear, right? The knowledge of fear. That is, you've lost somebody, or somebody has given you the feeling of insecurity, not being able to understand, to grasp, to all that. You follow? You have, is knowledge part of fear? Huh? You follow? You're attached to somebody. And that attachment has given you safety, security, a sense of communion, talking over. And the ending of it creates a sense of insecurity, right? Does that insecurity create fear? Obviously. Which is what? The knowledge of ending something might bring about more pain or more uncertainty. Right? So, there is fear. That is, does knowledge of a past experience create fear? Very concrete. So, isn't knowledge time? Both the you need to have time to learn a language, learn a technique that requires time. And the psychological accumulation of knowledge is also time. So I'm asking, we are asking each other, does this accumulated knowledge psychologically, is that one of the factors or maybe a central factor of fear? You understand all this? Come on, sir. That is, the previous knowledge of being secure in attachment, that knowledge, letting that knowledge go, creates fear. Right? So knowledge is knowledge, psychological knowledge, one of the causes of fear. I wonder, you mean, all right? Please, sirs, bear in mind, at the end of the talk, talking over together, walk out without a single shadow of fear, psychologically. Otherwise, this talking over together means nothing. Is fear a movement of thought? You understand? That is, there has been fear in the past. There is the memory of that, the remembrance of that, and the remembrance is movement of thought. Right? Which again is the movement of knowledge. Right? And this knowledge is stored up in the brain. And this knowledge is me. Right? When I say I am attached to you, I am attached to you because you are the audience and I derive great pleasure from it. Because I can talk to you, fulfill myself, all that nonsense. And that gives me a great sense of fulfilling. So, thought has experienced this sense of power. That thought then says, if I let this go, I'm frightened. I'm nothing. Right? So is fear the cause of me, I? Go into it, sirs. This is a very serious thing we are saying. As long as there is this central entity with its self-centered activity, which is desire, attachment, greed, you will always have fear. Right? So when you understand all this, not words, not ideas, not through the intellect has its place, to this understanding is to see totally this whole fabric. That means to have immediate insight into the nature of fear. Then perhaps only there will be love. Fear and love cannot go together. See what we have done? We know that very well, consciously, or even unconsciously, we know that. But as we haven't resolved that problem between human beings, we say, well, let's love God. You understand, sirs? How we have transferred that which must exist between human beings, and that can only exist when there is no fear. We have transferred that love to some object created by thought. And we are satisfied with that. Because it's very convenient that we can keep ourselves individual, self-centered, anxious, frightened, greedy, attached, and talk about love of God, which is sheer irrational nonsense. So, at the end of our talking together this morning, as two friends who are involved with this problem, who are concerned with the social order, which is disorder, and seeing that there must be a transformation in oneself before society can be changed, they are talking over together this problem. Of desire, greed, attachment and fear. That's the pattern in which we have lived. In that pattern, we have found great security. And that pattern there is fear. And no, seeing that totally is to have an insight into it. And when you have an insight, the whole problem is completely changed, broken. Can we say that to ourselves honestly? That we have broken this pattern of fear. When you walk out of this place, to know, to be free of this thing, then you become a rational, sane human being. Unfortunately, we are not that now. What time is it, sir? 20 to 1. Sorry to keep you so long.